Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You hear news like this, and your first thought is, how awful.
To the unfolding situation in San Bernardino, California, about an hour east of Los Angeles. Earlier today, a mass shooting took place at a social services office.
A young mother who arrived here on a fiancé visa may have radicalized her husband, pledging allegiance to the leader of ISIS as the couple turned a holiday party into a killing field.
The links between the Paris and the Brussels attacks have clearly been established.
Two of the suicide bombers in Tuesday's attacks were on U.S. radar and known to authorities.
Terror in Pakistan. Dozens of people, reportedly mostly women and children, are dead after a suspected suicide bombing ripped through a public park.
As we digest the shock and horror of terrorism, most of us have another thought, a question really. How could someone do such a thing? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It's hard to fathom what could possess anybody to commit acts of terrorism. It just makes no sense to most of us. Are all terrorists mentally ill? Are they all coerced somehow by some evil genius? Psychologists believe neither of those things are necessarily true. Instead, there is a fairly predictable pattern by which regular people can be converted to extremist thinking as a matter of group dynamics. The good news and the bad news is that the way we respond to acts of terrorism may have a direct effect on the success of terrorist organization recruitment practices. Claudia Wallace joins us to talk about this. She is managing editor of Scientific American Mind magazine. The current issue, April-May, features a number of articles on the psychology of terrorism. Claudia, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
You know, we think about terrorists and they seem almost like a different species to us, right? In fact, most are people who we might have related to before radicalization.
Yes. I mean, I think we tend to think of terrorists as monsters. This is not actually what psychologists say, but it's inevitable that we think about them because their acts are so monstrous.
And not only are they not monstrous to begin with, most are not mentally ill.
That really seems to be true. I'm sure there are isolated individuals who are, in fact, sadists and mentally ill. But when you think of the many thousands who get recruited by groups like ISIS, the majority are not mentally ill.
The phenomenon of radicalization is the dark side of our innate human need to belong. It starts with the sense that the broader world doesn't understand or accept us, but this one group does.
It's true. We are, as humans, social creatures, programmed to be social by, you know, many years of evolution. And we affiliate. It's built into us. And this tendency can go very badly awry.
Why is it that we start to mistrust authority when we feel misunderstood by the broader world?
Well, I think we look to authority to, you know, set the basic boundaries of everyday life for us in a fair way. And sometimes we're deeply disappointed and become quite disenfranchised and alienated from authority.
So if authority figures somehow have declared us, you know, invalid, our ideas invalid, we assume that they can't be trusted and we need to take matters into our own hands?
I think it's a more gradual process, particularly as it relates to people who become radicalized. You know, people, the experts who wrote our cover package of stories, you know, talk about multiple steps towards radicalization, which we can talk about. We have five expert authors who contributed three articles to this package, and they each bring a little something different.
How do extremists find potential recruits to their causes? What's the first step?
Most of it happens these days over the internet. And young people spend a lot of time on the internet, and it's easy, surprisingly easy, to get caught up in this sort of alternate universe. And it's particularly easy if you're feeling, as so many young people do when they're teenagers, feeling a little bit alienated, a little bit uncertain about your identity, that can play into it. But there's plenty of alluring sites out there.
And the groups themselves are structured to be very persuasive, perhaps deliberately or perhaps accidentally, but it turns out to be very effective in terms of bringing people on board and getting them signed on to these radical causes.
Well, one of our authors talks about four stages of recruitment. This is Dunia Buzar. She's a French anthropologist by training, but she runs a center in France that actually tries to prevent people from being radicalized and tries to intervene for those who have been. So she says the very first step is isolation from your friends and family. And that is sort of the very first thing that these websites and active recruiters do, is try to convince the individual that the world that you know out there, including your own family, can't really be trusted.
This was really interesting. A pattern that experts have noted is that some of these groups will use some information that is verifiable. You can look it up elsewhere and see that what they're saying is true. And then they'll mix in things that aren't true. But at that point, the potential recruit is more likely to doubt the information that's untrue because they're starting to trust the group.
Yes, I think it's really diabolically clever what they do. And they'll even use popular culture images like the Matrix. You know, do you want the red pill or the blue pill? Do you want to wake up or remain asleep to what's really going on in our world? It's a pretty paranoid world, but yes, they do use some real things as well as popular culture to attract young recruits.
And of course it's alluring when you have met up with a group and begin to be accepted by a group that seems to understand the world, have a secret to living that the rest of us lack.
And that's really step two, that they start to convince the individual that only the purest kind of Islam, in other words, extremist Islam, really holds the answer. And they start to persuade the recruit that he or she is among the few who really have the potential to understand and get this.
And as has been demonstrated by experiments here in the U.S., it doesn't take very long at all for people to begin identifying with the roles that they've either been given or have taken on within a group.
Well, it's very interesting. Let me just say one thing first, too, because your listeners might be interested to know that very often the people who are recruited are actually not very religious at all to start with. Buzar says that most of the young people she's worked with started out being, you know, completely agnostic, not involved in their religion, not recent immigrants. And it just is surprising because at some level we're all kind of vulnerable. You wouldn't think it, but we are.
And a percentage of people who become Islamic terrorists, at least in France, were raised Christian or even Jewish. That was really interesting.
That really surprised me. But this is what she says. She's worked with hundreds of families, and she said something like 3% of her clients were from Jewish families. I have no way to verify that. I'll just put that out there, but because her information is private. But this is what she says.
So things start to feel so right within the group that members believe the whole world would be better if the whole world lived by the codes practiced by the group. Is that right?
Well, I think you begin to believe that's more or less right. Or basically, they begin to paint a "you're with us" or "you're against us." You know, you're not either you're with us all in, or you're not really a human being. That's kind of how they start to paint the world. Very, very black and white.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I think it's interesting, too, that some of our other authors described. They quoted literature, recruitment literature. I think it's the magazine of ISIS that talks about eliminating the gray zone. And they made that reference. The gray zone is where you think it's okay to be a Westerner and have some Western values. That if you're a Muslim and you're not all in with the extremist point of view, that's the gray zone. And they don't want that. They want you to be pure, absolutely pure, or else you're not worth keeping around.
So people become really invested in being part of this group because being part of it is this, you know, great sense of acceptance and purpose. And eliminating the gray zone, that's basically how you isolate people from friends and family who might have more moderate views.
I think that's a big part of it, yes.
What's the difference between being persuaded by social identity as opposed to social pressure? They sound close to one another, but in fact, they're different.
Well, I think you might be talking about creating a new social identity where you're part of a group as opposed to being pressured by, say, a charismatic leader. Is that what you're referring to there, Chris? Yeah, I think one of the interesting things that our authors, Alex Haslam and Stephen Reicher, both social psychologists, say is that we used to think, you know, back in the days of experiments like the Stanford Prison Experiment or, you know, the famous work at Yale where people gave innocent victims supposedly shocks, including deadly shocks. We used to think that people become compelled to do these bizarre and dangerous things because they're surrendering to an authority. And I think people commonly think that's what's happening in Islamic extremism as well, you know, that you get a charismatic leader like Osama bin Laden and people surrender to that authority and then become merged in this, lost in this group identity. But that's not really what was happening with those experiments, we now think. And that's not really what's happening with radicalization. It's actually not a passive obedience to authority. It's more of an active choice of joining this new identity, this new group identity that seems noble and pure and, you know, that you actively select.
So what that suggests is that simply taking out the top of these groups is not going to be enough to cause them to collapse.
I think not. It does suggest that. Although I think taking out the top of the group certainly has an impact on how well they can be organized. But we know that little cells like the ones in Brussels, you know, act fairly independently. They plan their own actions. They may have gone to central ISIS for training, but I think that it's isn't that more like the way we picture terrorists? Little cells spread out, doing their own thing, not being pulled like puppets from the top.
We're speaking this hour with Claudia Wallace, managing editor of Scientific American Mind magazine. The current issue features a package of articles on the psychology of terrorism. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program, where students can customize their degree, like Lonnie Gentry, pursuing healthcare leadership and ethics. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the managing editor of Scientific American Mind magazine, Claudia Wallace. The current issue of the magazine features a number of articles on the psychology of terrorism. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Claudia, given the destructiveness, the bloodthirst that we associate with a group like ISIS, I was surprised to learn that their propaganda materials, their online presence, are not largely focused on violence.
Yes. We see all those violent videos and the beheadings, and so we get this impression that it's all bloodthirsty horror. But that's not really how they recruit people for the most part. One study found, I think, that only that 95% of the recruitment materials are not like that. It's more of a vision of a perfect world, reestablishing this Islamic caliphate, a better world that everyone could be proud to be part of. That's their appealing message.
And so what happens if one believes that this is the route to a better world, then killing that they determine has to happen seems like a necessary evil to people. Is that right?
That's our understanding. Hmm. Yeah, that it's unfortunate, but this is the only way we can get where we need to get.
What's going on in cases where people who join these groups are willing to die for the cause?
Well, I can only speak from, you know, the studies that I've – our authors
right,
cite.
Right.
You know, I just want to be clear. I don't have personal knowledge of this. But why are they willing to sacrifice themselves? Why are they willing to blow themselves up with suicide vests and all that? It's really all part of this dream of achieving this kind of utopian Islamic future. And who isn't willing to die for that? You know, they believe, of course, they have a belief in heaven and an afterlife for them, but they also see this as a glorious cause.
Why do young people seem particularly susceptible to radicalization? Is there something about young adulthood that makes us vulnerable?
Oh, I think that's undeniable. I mean, how many crazy things do we all do in our youth? You know, maybe they don't involve blowing things up. Maybe they do. But, you know, we could talk about how cognitively you're not mature until your late 20s. You're more impulsive. You're more prone, you know, just in terms of the brain, much more prone to take risks. Your identity is not fully formed.
Mm. So we often have the sense that terrorists are more often men than women, and I think statistically that's true. But there are some really distinct ways that terror cells and radical groups are looking to attract young women. Can you talk about some of those?
Well, this comes from, again, Dunia Buzar, this expert in France who works with families and helps deprogram their recruited young people. And what she says is that in recent years, there's been growing sophistication about how the recruiters work and the way they target girls in particular they have types that they play to. So if you've been abused, and a lot of young women have been, if you've been sexually abused, they'll promise, you know, a marriage to a religious, respectful man with a Kalashnikov who will protect you forever. You know, if you sometimes they'll recruit people who they'll see in the Facebook profile that someone is, you know, oriented towards humanitarianism and doing good and wants to, say, be a nurse and help refugees. And they'll recruit with that. You'll have this opportunity to do good. You can help refugees. They're very sophisticated. They actually get inside, you know, they find out as much as possible from Facebook profiles and postings, and then they can use that information with specific appeals.
This entire series was so interesting to me and really changed my understanding of how regular people could be radicalized. I have to tell you, I was stunned to read the ways that we may be unintentionally really promoting this kind of thinking. Can you talk a little bit about the implications of overreaction beyond targeting terrorists themselves, overreaction to the fear of terrorism?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that, because in some ways that's really the most important take home. Certainly one of them. What psychologists, social psychologists talk about is a kind of co-radicalization. And this term actually comes from Douglas Pratt, a religion scholar in New Zealand. And the idea is that the more it's like the radicals, the extremists, drive us to react with in the most extreme way we can, because that helps them recruit. Our authors say terrorism is not so much about spreading fear, that's what we think it's about, but it's really about seeding retaliation and further conflict. So it's this idea that the more we make statements, like take Donald Trump's famous statement about wanting to exclude Islamic, Muslims, exclude Muslims from entering the country, that kind of statement plays right into the hands of the extremists. And in fact, that statement was picked up by an al-Qaeda affiliate and used in its propaganda. So we have this, the more we overreact, and it's hard not to overreact, let's face it, this is very scary stuff going on, but the more we overreact and paint all Muslims into a corner as being dangerous, the more we're really playing the game of the extremists. We're helping them when we do that.
So suggestions, for example, like patrolling all Muslim neighborhoods, it breeds radicalization rather than quells it, rather than having, people within those neighborhoods think, I better, be on my best behavior, people feel persecuted.
It makes the people more vulnerable to the messages and overtures of the extremists. Stephen Reicher, one of our authors, did a study. He's based in Scotland, and he did a study about Scottish Muslims coming in to the airports where they felt they were coming home because they live in Scotland and maybe they were born there and maybe they've always lived there. And when they feel that, and his study found that when they come home to Scotland and find themselves subject to, additional scrutiny by border police, and that makes them feel very alienated. And he has very interesting direct quotes about how they start to feel like, well, maybe I'm foolish to think that I'm really welcome here, and maybe I'm foolish to defend the authorities to friends of mine who are questioning them. It's the kind of behavior that really does fuel the radicalization. It takes more than just that for someone to become radicalized, but it opens a door.
Claudia, did you get a sense from working with these experts and editing these pieces of how it is, there are people who come to believe in what most people would consider kind of extreme positions, but don't get to that final stage where they are willing to commit acts of violence, where they're actively plotting violence, where they're willing to sacrifice themselves physically for a cause. Do you have a sense of what the final thing is that causes someone to go from having really extreme ways of thinking to acting on them?
Well, from what our experts say, it's really that last step happens when you really become disconnected from the over larger group. You're no longer a part of the mainstream, or you reject it completely. You don't see yourself as part of it. You see it as other. You see it as wrong. you have to get to that spot where, you know, your ideological purity and a kind of you no longer see the ordinary guy, even your own mother for that matter, as fully human, because they just don't get it. I think that's the step.
So that also would explain why, you know, ideological moderates have a hard time convincing radicals not to act on this way of thinking.
Well, you know, one of the things Buzar says, that once someone has reached that last stage of radicalization, is fully radicalized, you can't really talk to them. You can't really reach them with reason at all. Her experience working with families, and she advises the families, don't even try. It's just going to go badly. The only way to reach someone who's gone that far to the radical side is through the tug of emotion. You know, she advises families who have a radicalized son or daughter to leave photographs around the house that might remind them of good times that they've had with their family, you know, leave visual reminders so that begin to build a bridge that way. But no, you can't really, I don't think talk works at that point.
Those bridges are really interesting, and there are strategies that have worked to help families sort of bring back to reality a loved one who seems to be lost to these ways of thinking, but they take patience, they take an understanding of nuance. It seems like at any moment, progress that has been made toward, you know, reclaiming someone for good can be ruined if somebody makes the wrong move.
That's certainly what Buzar says. She says it's a very delicate process. And one thing she does to tip the balance is once she's got someone kind of on the line and at least talking to their family again, she brings in other people who had been recruited and were deprogrammed, you know, had stepped away from radicalization. And those people are helpful and instrumental in trying to open the eyes of the recruit to the radical message is not really what you think it is.
So they might say, like, well, I was like you, but then I discovered there was hypocrisy within the group, or, you know, people weren't doing what they said they were going to do. They talk about why they became disaffected with the radical group. Is that right?
Exactly right. Yeah.
I was fascinated to read that sometimes these people who are early in the stages of maybe being de-radicalized, they will have these moments of doubt and ambivalence, but then sometimes they'll snap back. They will really respond against the people who are trying to help them see the light, like, why should I trust you? And they have to help them navigate through that.
Well, there's a fantastic quote in the article that I'll just quickly read, because it's, I don't think you can do better than this. It's from someone who was being, you know, who had been recruited and now was sort of halfway stepping back, and this guy says, one day I told myself my recruiters were terrorists, bloody executioners who played football with severed heads, and I was wondering how they could call what they were doing a religious activity. An hour later, I was sure that those who wanted to disindoctrinate me were working for the Zionists, and we needed to kill them. So that's the kind of, I guess, if you're really on the edge. It's hard for us, I think, it's hard for me to imagine holding those ideas in my head at the same time. Really hard to imagine. I guess it's really quite a process to bring someone back.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Frank in the Colony. Hi, Frank.
Hello. I just wanted to comment on how surprised you all were about individuals from various religions even getting involved with ISIS, when religion in itself kind of entails this noble idea and idealism, which we don't see in the world and we don't see in many organized religions. So young people and even some adults are seeing a group like ISIS as another area to explore, even though, like you said, those that get involved, then they eventually come to the thought that, wow, this is crazy.
Some come to that thought, Frank. Some get really lost in it.
I guess, you know, it sort of speaks to the idea that almost universally, no matter who we are and what we believe, we all want to believe we're doing the right thing. Like, people who are doing terrorism seem to believe that ultimately the result will be a better world rather than a worse one.
I think that's true. And there's also, you know, our last piece of our package, which we didn't really discuss, looks at seven studies and that have to do with how we identify and who we identify with and how we end up believing what we believe. And it's very interesting. One of them, which is about, it's called the false consensus study. We have a natural tendency to believe that what we think and the beliefs we hold dear are normal and shared by most people, even when they're, you know, can be completely radical. There's this tendency. This is very well established by research. That and really the only answer to that, you know, that illusion that everyone thinks the way I do, or that lots of people do, the only answer really is for us and our leaders to, you know, make a practice of questioning our assumptions.
It's so easy to think that other people should question their own assumptions. It's not so easy to take that on for ourselves as individuals.
Really hard. It's, you know, I think that's why one reason people, you know, Abraham Lincoln so famously surrounded himself with that so-called band of rivals, one of the keys to his success, right? He routinely had people question his assumptions.
We're speaking this hour with Claudia Wallace. She's managing editor of Scientific American Mind magazine, which in the April-May issue has a package of articles on the psychology of terrorism. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can customize your master's degree to distinguish yourself in the workplace. You can apply now for summer. Deadline is May 1st. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Claudia Wallace, managing editor of Scientific American Mind magazine. It's the May-June issue of the magazine that features a package of articles on the psychology of terrorism. Claudia, forgive me for making that mistake earlier, but thank you for the correction.
No problem.
If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Stephen in Denton. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. My question is, well, basically you've said that the these groups use utopianism and the idea that everybody thinks like you to bring people to their cause. And I think that in mainstream politics in the United States, we see a lot of those arguments being made. So I wonder how extremist we're becoming as a country.
Want to comment on that, Claudia?
Well, I think right now in the silly season as we walk up to the presidential election, we're seeing a lot of extreme views being presented. Maybe it will shake out in the general election. I don't know. I don't think I would, even with some of the more, even as black and white as our politics have become, I don't think it could compare to that eliminating the gray zone idea I referred to earlier. I think there are still lots of people in the middle, not in an extreme camp. So I don't think we're there.
It does seem to be a concern, though, for the experts who write here that we, as we discussed briefly earlier, will overreact, will paint the dangerous element with far too broad a brush and include people who really have, who start with no ill intentions whatsoever toward our society.
Well, I think it's really, one of the reasons we wanted to do this series of stories is to hopefully influence the conversation a little bit. Because, yes, if we do get driven to extreme positions and talk in a militant way, using a broad brush anti-Muslim language, we're playing right into the hands of the extremists.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Athanasia in Dallas. Hi, Athanasia.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Well, I have a comment. One of the things that was said was there was some surprise over the people being radicalized claiming to be secular, but I just wanted to comment that that doesn't surprise me because I imagine the people who were raised religious have a sort of litmus test to be able to say this message isn't right, this doesn't represent my faith, whereas someone who doesn't have that or didn't have those examples of piety in that religion might be more susceptible to this way of branding it. And I wanted to get the comment.
I think it's a very interesting point. I don't feel like I know enough about the range of beliefs of recruits to give you a really informed comment on that. I think it's a very interesting theory.
One thing that seems to be really important is that we all take action when we start to see danger. And one of the pieces that is quoted talks about like bystander intervention in emergencies, because sometimes, you know, things start pretty small, emergencies could be survived, but we look around us and no one else seems to be doing anything, and so we wait.
Yeah, there's an absolutely beautiful classic psychology study on this. And the setup is that the people who are participating in the study are in a room that's gradually filling with smoke. And it's getting harder and harder to breathe in the room. And it turns out if you're alone in that room, 75% of people will report smoke condition. If you're in a group of three, you'll kind of look at what's everyone else doing. And only 38% will report. And if you're in that room with two people who are accomplices to the study and are intentionally blasé and ignoring it, only 1 in 10 people will report the smoke. So we have this, it's a kind of, we take our cues from other people, and that can be a problem when we actually need to wake up and see a danger.
I would have a hard time believing that, except that I've experienced something almost exactly like that. That was not, it was not an experiment. I was at an event and the fire alarm started going off and saying, evacuate the building. And it was a room full of people and there was no smoke visible and we couldn't smell anything, but the alarm kept going off. And we all just looked at each other and assumed that if there were really an emergency, someone else would know and start, you know, exiting the building, and no one did.
I've been in that situation as well, though it's always interesting to me. There's always at least 1 or 2 people who will get up and leave, but they're usually the minority.
They'll be the survivors if something really does
exactly
happen. All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Osama on the line in Dallas. Hi, Osama.
Hey, how are you guys?
Very well, thanks.
Hello. Good. So first of all, I want to thank both of you guys, Claudia and you, Chris, because this is a very interesting conversation, and I love it. So thank you for informing us and informing the general public. But I want to touch base on two things here. First one is the recruiting, and the second thing is the radicalism or terrorism in general. So I'm from Syria originally. I was born as a Muslim, and I have seen it firsthand, suffering from terrorism, my family, my friends, and everyone back there. So when we're talking about terrorism, we are talking about an ideology. We are not talking about a country with a flag and national anthem that we can go and fight. We need to fight the terrorism in different way. We have to speak their language like terrorists in general speak the language of the victim of when they recruit them, and when I call them victim, because they have so many different kind of people who they recruit. Some of them are educated, some of them are women, like Claudia said, and they promise them to be safe, or they promise them of that man, religious man, who's going to protect them. So technically, they speak their language. What we need to do is, and just this is my opinion, is we need to use their same way, not fight them. We need to, because there is a huge movement right now against that. People are realizing what kind of failure they are. Yes, they recruit some people, but at the same time, people understanding that they are nothing. They are really not the true religious people. And like I said, I was born as a Muslim, but I have changed my opinion in so many different things. This is what we need to pay attention for. This is what we need to fight. There's no country we can go fight. We have tried in Iraq. We have tried in Afghanistan, but we failed. The reason why we failed, because they are still there.
Salma, thank you so much for your call. A lot on the table there, Claudia, but is there anything that you wanted to go back to and comment on?
Well, Osama, I'm wondering about how would that conversation happen? I think, for example, when President Obama spoke at a mosque, made a point of giving a speech to a Muslim audience, is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
No. So there is a movie. I don't know if you watch it, for Colony. Its name is Syriana. And this movie will touch base exactly in how recruiting happens, right? And to Obama's point, you're right. There is a backward move. Like, there is a movement that we need to take advantage of. We need to look at it and see that people who's not buying into what Al-Qaeda is saying. So what you're doing for those, yeah, there is people who's buying into them, but there is people who are not. A lot of people, actually, we know that they are nothing but a fail.
Oh, so for example, I guess the idea is, you know, there are recruitment efforts. Some people get pulled in, but lots of people don't. They might encounter those recruitment materials and walk away. And maybe what can we learn from that? Any thoughts on that, Claudia?
I think that would be worth examining. You know, I don't know how you find those people, you know. I don't know how you engage them, but if you could recruit them and talk to them, there might be some important lessons there.
Are there efforts? I mean, have you seen efforts? It sounds like France is beginning to wake up to this idea, the recognition that somehow we need to find ways to make everyone feel welcome within the societies that they are part of.
Well, that's one of the strong points being made by our authors, that if we don't, as I said earlier about the Scottish Islamic people who live in Scotland, don't make them feel unwelcome when they come home to the land they live in, it is an important message. And I think it goes a long way toward stopping and disrupting that alienation that leads people vulnerable.
I'm also curious about what we can learn by talking to people who were formerly radicalized. Is it a pattern by which people become disenchanted with these philosophies and realize they're not true, or does everybody, are there as many stories as there are former radicals?
Well, it's probably the latter, don't you think?
Yeah.
Chris? You know, what our author Buzar said, you know, is talking about is a particular subset of people who don't wake up on their own and have to be kind of gradually pulled back into their former life and reconnected. But there are, I'm sure you've read in papers, I have, of people who do become disenchanted on their own and start to see that the promise of ISIS is false. Actually, the more they lose, too, the more they don't achieve their aims, the more their premise falls apart, which is an argument for military defeat, I suppose.
We have an email here from Shelley in Dallas who wants to know, are there telltale signs parents can look for in their children that might be warning signs that the child is ripe for recruitment?
Wow, what a great question. I think, from what I can tell, you know, if your child is closing him or herself off in a room and really not connecting with former friends very much, it's starting to get more isolated, changing the way they dress, changing, you know, the way they speak. There are some obvious patterns of behavior, quoting scripture where they never used to, you know, just giving up friends would be a really big warning sign, big red flag.
It's fascinating to me, and I know that scholars have been working on these questions, but, you know, you have pulled all of this research together in one place for the May-June issue. It seems like these are questions that, you know, average Americans should have been asking a very long time ago, not, you know, at the very least after 9/11. Why do you think it's taken this long for people to get really curious about what's actually happening within radical groups?
Well, that's a good question. I don't really know the answer. I could just say that I think our initial reaction, say back in 9/11, you know, was just rage and shock. And I think we all tend to react very emotionally first. It takes a little time to get to a calm enough place where you begin to say, well, what do we really know? What does science tell us? Do we actually have research-based information that we can work with that can, A, help us understand what's happening, and B, guide us in our responses? I think that's not the instinctive thing when you're scared.
Even recognizing that it may be, you know, we would never deserve terrorist activity, and yet, without meaning to, we might be encouraging terrorist recruitment by the things we're doing to try to protect ourselves.
Yeah, it's a real conundrum, because if you're a politician and you appear to be soft on terrorism, yeah, you're going to be walloped. You're going to be criticized. I mean, as you know, I don't think that, again, to cite the example of the president speaking at a mosque, that was not necessarily a popular thing he did. But it may have been tremendously important.
Claudia Wallace is managing editor of Scientific American Mind magazine. The May-June issue features a number of articles on the psychology of terrorism. And when does that issue drop at newsstands approximately, Claudia?
That will be out on April 19th.
Okay.
So pretty soon.
Not too long to wait. All right, Claudia, thank you so much for making this time for us. I really appreciate it.
It was really my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Stephanie Kuo. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.